So Kellyanne, you're Mr. Trump's campaign manager. What we're dealing with here are reports that the candidate visited dressing rooms of beauty pageants that he owned while the contestants were in various stages of nudity.
I don't know anything about that. I'm his campaign manager. Right now, October 13th, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, that was the past. I don't know about the past.
We have an interview with somebody who was there. This is the former Miss Utah in the Miss Underage Totally Off Limits beauty pageant.
Mr. Trump came in while we were dressing for the swimsuit competition, and he took off his own...
Stop playing that clip. Stop it. I don't know about it at all. Nothing. I was not even in the Miss Jailbait pageant or whatever it was. I do not know about it. Do you get that?
Well, as his campaign manager, couldn't you ask him?
How would I do that?
You could call him. You could say, "Hi, it's me, your campaign manager. Did you look at naked girls? Did you grope a woman on an airplane? Did you back a reporter up against a wall?"
I'm not able to ask the candidate questions, and I'm not able to find out whether things in the past really happened. Something is wrong with space and time. We have a statement coming today from a top physicist.
Stephen Hawking?
Who? No, just some random guy at a secretarial college in New Jersey.
This just in. We have a new report of a woman who says she was...
See, now I can't even hear you because solar flares are bouncing off the frim-fram field. I gotta go. There are some people talking about, I hope, not groping. And now he likes the way Donald touches him. Colin McEnroe.
As we planned this season, I just said, we'll just hold the October thing open for an election show. We don't know what the show will be, but we know that everybody's going to want to talk about that. I couldn't have been more right, apparently. Look, we've never had as big a crowd here. We've got a great panel, exactly the panel that I hoped we got, sitting furthest away from me, but closest to my heart, Vivian Martin. She is a professor and a chair. She is Dr. Vivian Martin, if it comes right down to it. She is chair of the journalism department at Central Connecticut State University. Dan Haar is sitting next to her. He is, of course, a columnist for the Hartford Courant. And then sitting immediately next to me is Ross Garber. He is a partner at Shipman & Goodwin. We're going to talk, obviously, I think a lot of people feel as though, I mean, we're calling this Honey, I Broke the Democracy. And I think a lot of people do feel as though important institutions of our democracy aren't working the way they're supposed to work. And we're also wondering what it's going to take to get them back, assuming they're repairable. The question that I told the panelists we'd begin with, and Ross, I'll begin with you since you're sitting closest to me. You know, as you look at the 2016 election cycle, does this seem as though it is a cycle, that we are simply cycling through one phase of our political process and of our political history? Or does it seem as though something very different, something sui generis is happening, something that might depart so far from the norm as to not be possible to cycle out of?
You know, when I ran for attorney general, you know, I saw the Tea Party making, you know, significant waves. This was back in 2010, and the question I was asked most was what I would do as attorney general of Connecticut to deal with illegal immigration. This was 2010. This was Connecticut. We're obviously not a border state. I assume they weren't talking about Rhode Island. And so I think what this election cycle has told me is that it's part of a trend that didn't start with Donald Trump and didn't start with Bernie Sanders, and it didn't start in 2010, but it's been percolating for quite a while. I mean, take a look at Congress, for example. Listen to Ted Cruz. 20 years ago, I think many of the things that Ted Cruz and even Marco Rubio and some other Republicans said would have been viewed as incredibly, incredibly extreme. But in this election cycle, they were viewed as moderates. And I'll confess, I've been involved in Republican politics for a long time. I worked on the Reagan-Bush campaign when I was in junior high school. So this, I think, has been percolating for a long time. And I think the important thing, and I think we'll get to the lessons, is that we pay attention to it. We don't view it as just an anomaly. We don't view it as just a part of a cycle even. But we look at it and ask ourselves, what does it say about the state of our country? What does it say about our populace? and what does it say about our democracy?
I think Trump represents a blip, a downward blip. It's not going to be that bad forever, but at least it's sort of like this year on the drought and heat index, where it was the worst year ever. We can expect it won't continue if the same downward velocity, but at least it is a direction, and I think it's because of both engagement, economics, and education.
Can I disagree with Dan on two things? One is, I don't think Trump is going to be an extreme example of what we might see. That's number one. I think it actually could get, I think it could get more significant than Trump, number one. But I don't think it signals the decline or the end of the republic. I think the question is, what does this Trump thing tell us? You know, we were talking beforehand. Trump is not some marginal candidate. He's not some fringe player. I mean, he's got the support of essentially half of the American electorate. So what does that tell us? To me, one of the things it tells us is that he's not extreme. And the more we think that he's marginal, the more we treat him as marginal, I think the more danger the republic is actually in. Because then it's going to potentially prompt somebody who's even more extreme to come forward. I think one of our problems has been we have ignored the path that we've been on. We've ignored the rise of the Tea Party and the Ted Cruz's and on and on. We've ignored them. We've marginalized them. That's one. But I'm actually hopeful because I think, unlike what we saw in Turkey and unlike what we've seen in the Arab Spring, here in the United States, I think our system can accommodate that. And we actually can look at that. We can take it apart and we can tweak or adjust, maybe even significantly, our institutions of government to accommodate it and make some progress.
To that point, Vivian, that Ross is making, this idea that Trump is kind of a placeholder for a bunch of people and a bunch of ideas that were sitting there for a while. I mean, there's this notion, I think it's Josh Marshall from Talking Points Memo, who says he's been working for a long time on this piece about the self-radicalization of Donald Trump, by which he means that, or Gail Collins put it a different way. She said, if the crowds at the rallies were really interested in gardening, you know, half of his campaign would be about mulch. And Marshall's point is that Trump came to the campaign with a somewhat thin agenda, you know, a very, very bare-bones structure of rhetoric, and then went to the rallies, and just as people screamed affirmatively and clapped and got excited, that fleshed out his ideas, that he really hung meat on the bones of his ideas based on what people, thousands of people showing up at his rallies were telling him. I don't know. You're nodding as though this rings true.
I absolutely agree. I think that he tapped into something out there, and that's why we can't think of him as marginal, because it's there.
Clearly, we're coming to a point where every 4 or 8 years, just the word change is enough to motivate people to get really riled up and angry. And ideas are not at the heart of anything. It's a pop culture phenomenon. It's not about, even last night or at the debate last week when they're talking about specific points. I mean, the war on coal. Who thought that war on coal would become some kind of a rallying cry without one single word in 93 minutes about what the war on coal is about and what it means and what the cost of coal is and what the benefits of coal are to the both jobs and all that stuff? It's not about ideas. And if it's not about ideas, I'm having a hard time accepting that it isn't marginal, because it is in the fleeting category of pop culture that by definition is not about anything other than the moment.
Well, except I think very few things are actually about ideas. Like in this room, we pay a lot of attention to ideas. You know, we read, we think, we watch, we think, we talk. I think in real life, very few things are actually about ideas. They're about feelings. They're about, you know, motivations. And when people said, we want change a couple of cycles ago, they got change, but then they're saying, well, that's not enough. People on the right and the Bernie supporters, they're saying, no, I think you guys didn't really get it. Electing a U.S. senator is not the change that we were really looking for. And electing, you know, a former U.S. senator, secretary of state, that's not what we're talking about. And maybe even electing a reality TV star without ideas that we agree with. Maybe that's not even...
No, it's not ideas that we agree with. It's without ideas. With,
Well, right, just ideas.
Again,
right,
I'm trying to play the Republican on the panel. You know,
right.
I want to be a panelist for a second instead of the moderator and say something about that, which is that I do think that it's very significant where Donald Trump came from, and in particular how he got his fame, and a lot of it was in reality television. And there's a central fantasy, a psychological substructure to a lot of reality television. It's in American Idol, it's in The Apprentice, it's in Survivor, it's in The Bachelor and The Bachelorette. It's the central fantasy is that you can get rid of people. All of those shows end with an elimination every week.
It's true. Every
single one of those shows, and the fantasy also is you can get rid of the person who's not functioning very well, who's getting on people's nerves, who's not carrying his or her weight, that kind of thing. And obviously in real life, you can't do that. Right? I mean, it's very difficult to fire people. The people at work that you don't like, they're going to be there tomorrow when you go into work again. You're going to be eating Thanksgiving with the same people, Thanksgiving dinner with the same people for the next 30 years. You know, I mean, basically, people don't go anywhere. And that some of the structure of Trump's reality TV show, like so many other shows, was about elimination. I don't think it's any surprise that he's very successful with a message that includes that. People that you don't like, people who might interfere with your ability to be happy, can actually be eliminated from your midst. I want to also, Ross, there's a sense that we have, I think, that norms, the norms of political discourse, the norms of campaigning have, and presumably, therefore, also the norms of governing are a little bit broken in this election. It just seems like, you know, in the Lincoln-Douglas debates that Dan was talking about before, nobody talked about how fat Rosie O'Donnell got. I mean, you know, watching a presidential debate and people are talking about something like that, you just think there's something that's gone wrong here. And that Trump, in particular, is gifted at violating these things. But I've started to wonder about that, particularly as Trump began to bring up the experiences of the Clintons in the 90s. And I realized that, you know, I mean, Bill Clinton was really remarkable in the sense that he could run for president with the kind of personal baggage that he had going in, that Jennifer Flowers could materialize as an issue in the campaign, you know, in prior to New Hampshire, that he could push through that, in his second term, the Monica Lewinsky stuff could materialize. I remember being on the air with Bill Curry while someone was faxing to us. This is locates this story in the 90s. Somebody in Washington was page by page faxing us the Star Report, you know, and we'd get it during the commercials and we'd read it and our jaws would drop and we'd think, this can't be happening. This is not part of our understanding of the American presidency, that I'm reading a report like this from a prosecutor about the president. Then the Bush era came in. You know, we did things that we've never done before. We were pretty open about torturing people. We held people without charges, and a whole bunch of other norms got stood on their head. So that's a very long-winded question. But what I'm saying, I guess, is, you know, maybe it's the way of presidencies now that they change norms, that the game just always changes, that the thing that wasn't thinkable becomes thinkable.
Well, that's part of it. And I think it's the thing that I think Trump realizes that perhaps the other candidates didn't. And I actually think it's two things. One is, if you're going to run for office, you got to get attention. You know, it's why I'll never run for office again. I really liked sort of talking about the substantive policy issues, and I really like talking about the job. That's not what it's about. It's about getting attention. And these days, with all the social media and all the TV and all the ways we can get information, the way you get attention is by doing something outrageous. And it's why the press is covering Trump. It's not because of his ideas. It's because he demands the attention. He says stuff where you can't look away. That's number one. You know, the other thing is I think he also understands better than most of the other candidates, and it's something that Clinton also understood, which is sort of the power of a narrative. And I think he gets that his audience wants to sort of hear a story, hear their story, and it's different than ideas, and it's different than debates. And again, he can do it in a way that winds up attracting attention, but adhering to norms, it becomes a challenge.
All right, live from Watkins in School, we'll be right back after this.
That bastard making fun of me in front of all my peers. Those people think I own this town, you're stripping all my gears. Well, guess what, Mr. President, I'll be seeing you in 4 years. Though on the campaign trail the papers paint me like a clown, still all I see are crowds who want. crown. I point out all my enemies, just so my fans bring them down. Isn't anybody going to stop me? I don't want this job. I don't want this job.
All right, we're back. We're at Watkins in School with Vivian Martin, Dan Haar, and Ross Garber. We're talking about how the democracy got broken. Well, you know, Vivian, one of the startling experiences for me recently, right after the first debate, I asked my class the next night, I said, I want to go around the table. Each one of you describe to me exactly the circumstances under which and the equipment and software that was involved in your consuming the debate. In other words, I want to know what you watched the debate on, but I also want to know what kind of parallel programs you had running, what you were doing. And, I mean, it was more breathtaking than I thought it would be of 15 people. Nobody really had, no two people had an identical experience. You know, people were, in fact, doing a lot of simultaneous use of Twitter and Facebook and things like that. People were mixing different mediums. People were who had busy lives were, like, trying to follow the debates, getting out of work, picking up pizza, you know, and using all kinds of different ways to stay in touch. I think one guy was listening to NPR on the way home and then had it stream on his phone as he was coming up the sidewalk to his house. And one of the things that you realize is that a lot's going on, right? That the old monolithic top-down experience of consuming journalism, which is basically you watched something and then maybe Walter Cronkite or somebody told you what it was you just watched, is just so multi-layered now that when Matt Lauer was doing his commander-in-chief forum, he was already being gamed by other journalists right away. Like, you're watching it, you're watching on Twitter, people are ripping him to shreds, and meanwhile other people are playing both sides on social media. That, well, anyway, you get the idea that it's right. Just not the it's a different experience now.
Right. I happened to pay attention to that particularly last night because I had students who were fact-checking on an assignment. And there was some initial pushback because a few claimed that they were going to bed. And I mean, 20-year-olds going to bed at 9 o'clock, that's just not. But I did have that sense of that because students, some of them were at watch parties and other things. But I remember one student did tell me that she was fact-checking on her computer. She was tweeting on the phone, and they had the TV on. But one thing I want to say about that is that, and I was watching it in a room with a number of people, and people were doing different things too, not just millennials. You know, we had the TV on. I had my computer and my phone. And I noticed that when things would come up, people in the room would say, is that true? You Google that. My students were reporting similar experiences, so people were, they're less trustful. This election, it's making them Google and check certain facts, but it was just interesting that part of the screen experience was checking a lot of other information. And in fact, at one point, when Cain said that the Clinton Foundation is a highest rated foundation and that it's ranked higher than the Red Cross, a couple of my students went to check that out, and the website had crashed at one of the philanthropic sites because people were checking, because it's like, we can't believe these people. So they were running checks themselves on the claims. So
can I ask Vivian a question?
Yeah, yeah, you may.
So you're the chair of the CCSU journalism department. Yes. And one of the developments I think I've seen over the past bunch of years, and in fact, a couple of my dinner companions were talking about it, are the rise of podcasts and then also other low-cost reporting mechanisms. And I'm thinking of two examples. One is the James Foley story, which is on HBO. It's very, very good if you haven't seen it. It's about a guy who graduated from college. He was smart and curious and, like, went and got a real job and then wasn't very inspired by it. And so he said, screw it. And he bought a cheap camera and a cheap bulletproof vest and went off to war zones. And he became a war correspondent, and he discovered that that's sort of the model of war reporting, conflict reporting these days, is that anybody can do it and anybody does do it. That's one. And then second, I mean, you think about who broke the Melania, you know, Trump plagiarism scandal. It was like a guy sitting at a Starbucks. And so my question is,
I hear it coming.
Yeah. I mean, Are we potentially entering a golden era of journalism?
No.
Where, I didn't ask you, Dan, intentionally.
Well, parents ask this because, of course, when you chair a journalism program and their kids are coming to major in journalism, you know, they come at me like, well, where are your students working? Where do they get jobs? And, of course, our response, because our major is fairly new, it started in 2009 when we got approval, so I had to go before the state board. And, you know, people are just kind of looking at me like, journalism major. So right up front, I had to say, well, on some days I do feel like a Pied Piper, and I worry about what we're pushing. But I believe that there's always going to be a need for professionally produced information. And more to the point, there are different kinds of jobs. So that there are social media jobs that the students go into, and they need the same kind of training. We have students who work. Somebody just got a job at a global research company in New York where she's the healthcare reporter. So there are more companies that actually look for journalistic skills. If I had to be honest, and this is not just our school, but a lot of students are not interested in going into the war zone. They're not interested in being Woodward and Bernstein. They want to be on Entertainment Tonight. it's true. They want to do sports. We just launched a sports specialty, so that's an aspect of it too. But we also have these students who are interested in working for NGOs and putting their journalism skills there too. And there are more jobs that are being advertised by these groups that want people who want to do advocacy journalism. And we're sitting up in the class talking to them about being fair and
journalism
and all of these other things. And there are students who are just not interested in that. And I have somebody right now who's been accepted in the Peace Corps, and his thing is he'll do the Peace Corps, and then maybe if he finds a spot in advocacy journalism, being a journalist for the World Health Organization or something like that, he feels the skills are better there. A lot of the millennials have this attitude of, well, we're the solutions. When we give them assignments and they're supposed to be working on reporting what's going on, some of them do turn it around and say, well, I would be.
Well, yeah, I want to just jump in here, Dan. I'll tee this up for you exactly the way you want it anyway, I promise.
Is the Republic declining?
Yeah. So Ross, one of the things that I'm noticing is, as I'm teaching this class at Trinity, every week we strike one more thing off as essentially meaningless. It's kind of like, well, vice presidential debates don't really mean anything. Political ads don't really mean anything. Maybe presidential debates don't mean anything. Last night we were talking about fact-checking, and ultimately I said, do you think that fact-checking services like factcheck.org and PolitiFact, does it mean anything? And a lot of them said, no, not really, because ultimately people feel very free to reject knowledge that they don't like. Stephen Colbert, of course, famously said, facts have a well-known liberal bias. And Chris Christie said the same thing in the post-debate spin. He said, the fact-checking services can't be trusted. They're biased. And so, in a way, that gets us to this kind of reductive agnosticism where we have to start asking ourselves, what can we trust? How do you establish trust, enough trust in anything so that people can even begin to talk about it?
So long as I don't have to pretend I know what reductive agnosticism means. I think we are potentially entering into a golden era of journalism because it all, I think, is going to be in how you define it. So right now, we are all journalists at a certain level. If you have a Twitter feed, if you have a Facebook feed, if you've got a Snapchat feed, if you've got a cell phone camera, you can take information and blast it out to a lot of people. So you're potentially a journalist. I think where sort of the media institutions have a very, very important role is in actually getting it right. And that's where I think there actually can be vast improvement. We were talking a little bit earlier about a phrase that I've had reporters use with me when I ask them to actually get the facts right. And they tell me that they're practicing iterative journalism. Iterative journalism means that they post the story on their online format, and then they'll update it as they get actual facts. And so chill out, Ross. It's going to be okay in the end. We'll get around to actually getting it right at some point. And it's not just sort of the small regional papers, you know, and, you know, wherever in the country. But, you know, take a look at the corrections that the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and other media organizations make. Take a look at the corrections, because I think there's a role for them. And so I think, you know, these days I get sort of more of sort of the news I can use, I think, from, in a way, the New Yorker than from a lot of those daily papers. I think that there's a significant role to play there. And there may also be a role even for broadcast journalists to play in that area, because right now the broadcast journalists from the major networks are acting in many ways like, you know, they're kids with cell phones and that's it. And they're just throwing stuff out there. It is right now, I think, the Wild West of journalism. But I think that's when it might get interesting.
Obviously, Ross, we all missed something. We didn't get it. We didn't understand. We wound up with these two candidates. Many people would acknowledge that both candidates are deeply flawed. Maybe one of them is more grotesquely flawed than the other one. But these are flawed. And that we didn't understand something. We didn't see Trump's coming. We didn't see Bernie Sanders coming. So one of the questions is sort of, why didn't we see it coming? One of the arguments, there's a great piece in the Times today by a guy named Stephen Phillips from, I think, the Center for American Progress, where he said, well, maybe one thing is we don't, like Dan was so eloquently extolling the virtues of where we are right now, and we're a bunch of human beings sitting in a room. We're going to be all talking as the night goes on. What Stephen Phillips is saying is maybe personal contact is a little bit de-emphasized these days, you know, that what you really could do for the amount of money you're spending on useless campaign commercials that, in fact, don't change anybody's mind, you could put people in the field all year long talking to people in these neighborhoods, finding out exactly what they want, what really does concern them. Because, Ross, as we were saying even before the evening started, it shouldn't have been such a surprise to us. It shouldn't have been so ungraspable for not just the press, but the political establishment, that there were a set of concerns here that would fuel candidacies that nobody saw coming. So, you know, I'll throw that out as a possible solution. Are there ways to foster, you know, is that the solution, or do you see it another way?
I think there are a few issues. One is, you know, I won't ask for a show of hands for fear of embarrassing anybody, but I could ask for a show of hands of how many people in the room think their vote matters in the presidential election.
Well, let's do it. Let's do it. A bunch of them. Look at them.
Which state?
In Connecticut. No, your vote. Your vote. Your vote for president. There are some.
I'd say more than half.
Matters emotionally or to the outcome?
Yeah.
That, I think, is the point. That's actually what I was getting to. So we all know, I think, that it is unlikely that our individual votes are going to affect the actual outcome of the presidential race. But I think, especially in this room, we also recognize that our votes actually do matter. The notion of, you know, getting out of our houses and our offices and going to a polling place on one day, on a particular year, all of us, every one of us, actually does matter. And it matters for the democracy. It matters, I think, for everything that we've been talking about. And why do we think that? Especially when contrasted with, I think, what the real answer to the first question is. I think in some ways it may be sort of a demographic skew in this room, because, you know, I'm post-Vietnam. My generation had no war, really, that a significant part of the population fought in. And further generations had no war, no unifying cause that most of us had to participate in. And this is my way to shoehorn in the movie Fight Club. If you haven't seen it, you should, because that'll tell you everything about, I think, where we are politically. I think one of the things we can do is think about that issue. What's going on with the Bernie supporters? I think one of the things that's going on with the Bernie supporters is they are rallying around something or some number of things. They have a cause to believe in. I think it's the same thing with those Trump supporters. Are they rallying around an idea, like one idea? I don't think so, probably not. But they're rallying around something, and I think as human beings, we have a need, a desire to do that. And when we don't have that, well, then we just, you know, fight each other and things disintegrate. And so I think that's something to think about. Think about it in terms of our civic education in school. Think about it in terms of national service and increasing emphasis on national service for students and graduates. I think it's something to think about in terms of campaign finance issues. Yes, I'm a Republican, but I think when people perceive that they are disenfranchised in favor of, you know, big moneyed interest, it causes a challenge in the democracy. And I think one of the things Trump in particular has been skilled at has been giving people an other to fight against, which is, I think, in some ways the most powerful motive we can have. And unless we want that to be sort of the legacy of this election and sort of to be the next thing that we focus on is trying to figure out who the other is, I think we don't want to blame ourselves, but sort of take a look at our institutions and see whether there are ways to engage us further.
We could also do proportional awarding of electoral votes. Then all of their votes would matter.
Right.
Maybe our tough.
No, they wouldn't. No. Connecticut would be just as ignored.
Well, maybe.
It's just different places would be ignored for different reasons.
Yeah.
Sanders, I think, was a little bit more predictable. There's always been a white-haired liberal who rallies students. Eugene McCarthy, John Anderson, Barry Commoner, Ralph Nader. Sanders is part of a longer tradition, I think, a lot less unpredictable. Not to say that your point isn't valid, because Trump alone demonstrates the point that people are yearning for something.
Yeah, the superdelegates in the Democratic Party helped Hillary.
Well, that's right. Yes, that's right. There were too many superdelegates in the Democratic Party to stop Hillary, and there were too few superdelegates in the Republican Party to stop Trump.
So you want a Goldilocks.
That's exactly right. So 300, next time we know, 300 is the right number of superdelegates.
We'll take a break. We'll come right back. We're live from Watkinson School. Audience! Yay!
Feels like superdelegates. You say that you get to choose the president, but some would say that you're irrelevant. I know that subject is superdelegate, but let me tell you something about superdelegates.
This program was recorded before every American knew about Ken Bone, so obviously everything is different now. Today's show was produced by me, Kyone Wolf, with help from our friends at Event Resources. Greg Hill and Lydia Brown appeared in the intro, and special thanks to Jenny French. To hear all of our shows, visit us at WNPR.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, The Nose talks about two old white guys, Steve Martin and Bob Dylan. And now, back to Colin.
Okay, we've got one more segment here in our conversation about the political crisis of 2016 with Vivian Martin from CCSU, Ross Garber from Shipman and Goodwin, and Dan Haar from the Hartford Current. All right, let's go to questions here. Jenny is in great shape. She can run up and down these stairs all night.
What do you think the Republican Party will look like in 10 or 15 years?
Ross? No, just kidding.
Well, you know, I'm the wrong guy to ask, because I lost the Republican nomination despite getting the endorsement of virtually every newspaper in the state and every elected
or perhaps
Republican
official.
Well, so maybe. So the answer is I'm not sure, because it could either – and I think it's going to depend on personalities. It could either be a sort of, you know, Ted Cruz sort of, you know, very, very right of center kind of personality. That could be a place where the party decides to go. And I think that's sort of where it's been gravitating, you know, sort of the intransigence that Colin was describing, I think is largely a product of fear by elected Republicans that if they compromise, they're going to be viewed as not right enough. So that's one place where it could go, sort of increasingly there. It could also become more moderate. And if there were somebody, and I can't think of that person right now, but if there were somebody who was a more moderate conservative, libertarian bent, who was a compelling person.
Susan Collins.
John Huntsman. I could see the Republican Party adopting that person, but that would be a very risky and a very brave thing to do, because then there'd still have to be a home for, you know, the Ted Cruz's and that ilk. I think if we're smart, there's going to be a battle in the Republican Party. It's not going to sort of keep bumping along as it is. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure we're going to be that smart.
I think, Dan, that we know what the battle is going to be like, especially if Trump loses. Let's assume for a moment that Trump's going to lose. You know, what you're going to see is a battle that you basically saw in the late 60s and mostly in the 70s, culminating with Ronald Reagan, right? Ronald Reagan, after Goldwater, with a very extreme form of conservatism that freaked people out and tanked them, there was kind of a long battle in the party for control. And Ronald Reagan eventually came forward as a guy whose positions weren't all that different from Goldwater's, but they were presented in a much more palatable way, that he really knew, you know, how to move that much closer to a civilized center to get those across. If, you know, I mean, I'm assuming if Trump loses, there'll be a struggle like that one.
I certainly hope that doesn't happen, because in addition to the Goldwater backlash or turnaround, it took 12% inflation and 17% interest rates and 9% unemployment for Reagan to arise. And so I hope we don't see that. What we may start to see is more of a party of technocracy versus a party of ideology. And what I believe is that there are no right policy answers, as we saw with welfare reform. There isn't people. We all tend to think that it's right and good to do X, Y, and Z policies. And I'll bet there's a lot of agreement in this room, which is part of the problem. But the reality is that, for example, extending unemployment to 99 weeks, that was really, really stupid for people who took a 99-week vacation and could very well have gotten jobs. And it was really, really good for people that were just plain down and out and couldn't get jobs in places where there were no jobs. There are no right answers. There are more right ways of managing. And that rise of the technocracy, I think, is in some ways dangerous, but in some ways necessary. That may pair off against ideology, and so you have two different types of parties.
One of the things that's coming out of this is that people don't like the way they're given these two choices. So we also have to keep in the back of our mind, although I don't see a pathway for this at this point, that parties they implode, and we've been with our system for a very long time, and so it gets very difficult for them to imagine something imploding and splintering or a viable, because our system isn't really set up for that. But there are a lot of people out there who are asking for that, too.
And you see Ross coming back as a Whig, is what you're saying.
Well, I mean, it depends if Khloe Kardashian throws her hat in the ring.
Right.
You know, that could attract some people.
Kristen, what have you got up there?
So has the message delivered by the reasonable, intellectual, socially responsible people, a.k.a. know-it-alls, actually encouraged the ultra-conservative movement to move further and further to the center to escape, quote, smug liberal wrong ideals? Does the enlightened left bear responsibility for some of the ill will of the disenfranchised right?
So you're saying, is this Dan's fault? That's what you're asking.
I took that personally.
It's certainly, Michael Moore has a theory of this election that goes kind of like that. That this election, you know, I call it the Spicoli election. Do you remember, it's a Sean Penn character in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, the guy who like orders a pizza during class and stuff. You know, that Michael Moore's theory is that this in some ways does represent the rise of the people in your middle school class who weren't even interested in the restoration of order. You know, I mean, if a teacher was trying to restore order, they were the ones who were disturbing it, that they're resentful of all kinds of top-down information, and that this is their rebellion. I just quickly want to say that Michael Moore has this, I think it's Michael Moore, has this other theory of this election that's so great. And he says that one of the ways that Trump has prevailed is like this, that there's this whole idea, which I didn't even really know, that vampires have to count things. It's not just the count on Sesame Street, just vampires in general. Like, they have to count, like, grains of sand and stuff. And that, like, if you want to get away from a vampire, you throw up a handful of rice, and the vampire has to count it all while you run away. And that Trump has kind of done that to the press. He just throws up all this stuff, like 20 things, you know, and the press is this, they're kind of going, well, no, he said no, yeah, well, he said that too, you know. And meanwhile, Trump is running on to the next
thing. Right. That's actually, this PTSD statement of 2 days ago is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
It only got like a half a cycle of coverage, and yet for any other candidate at any other era, it would have been absolutely outrageous. The very idea that a candidate nominated by a major party running for president, as Ross says, half the electors, to say that people who suffer from PTSD are suffering because they're weak and can't handle it is phenomenally irresponsible and idiotic. And I think that gets my view of your question to that end is what I've been thinking about a lot lately is if you are a well-educated, urban professional who's community-minded, chances are you are for not Trump. And your question is not how do you deal with Trump as yourself as a voter. It's how do you deal with friends and family who are supporting Trump? Mm-hmm. And so do you ostracize them or do you empathize with them? And I'm looking at that very closely right now, and I find that they're slightly more humanist in the people, and they say let's let people vote how they want. That's the, you know, the Jim Bond theory. But there's also the question of, no, maybe these people don't deserve any empathy or sympathy or friendship even, right, and we're going to cut them off. And you laugh, right, but that's what's driving people to react strongly, right, against our strong, right, beliefs. And so I'm torn between my beliefs and my emotion.
Mm-hmm. I have that same thing, too, even in the classroom, because I do not talk my political views. I mean, I think some students know that I'll vote for Hillary, but I do not. I don't talk it. And part of it is because I know that with some of them, particularly since the whole Bernie thing, they feel that they are not listened to. And I've had to read a number of papers about this, about millennials not being listened to. And so I don't want to push so much, because I've seen some colleagues kind of like just jump on them and tell them, oh, no, you just can't do this. You can't vote for Gary Johnson. And so it's an interesting dynamic, because I don't want to push them into another column. So I just kind of hold back. But I do think that is a phenomena, that term, that whole.
I want to hear Ross. Ross, you have the hardest job of them all. In many respects. I mean, you are often talking to your fellow Republicans with whom you have made common cause in the past, and some of them, for various reasons, are Trump supporters, and you're not.
And outed. I didn't say that I wasn't.
I know you.
We've still got a while before Election Day, and there's a secret ballot, right? But I think this question, the one we've just been addressing, may be the most important question of the night. And I think we're going to disagree. I'm going to disagree with my friends on the panel on it. Because I think that Dan may have a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we marginalize half of the electorate who supports Donald Trump, if we marginalize them, if we call them the other, if we say they're whatever, label them, I think that's when we're going to get into trouble, because the message that we are sending them is that they are not powerful, is that they are marginalized, is that whatever they're trying to communicate, whatever it is not being heard and not being understood, which is one of the things, after all, I think is behind the Donald Trump movement. And so I actually have been fascinated. I probably hang out with more Republicans than other folks on the panel. And I have been very interested. That's probably not hard, right? But I have been interested to sort of hear where they're coming from. And whether it's, you know, in Connecticut or Washington or Alabama or wherever it is, where are they coming from? What's their perspective? And I think it's important that we hear it, because we may have another chance. We may have another chance to sort of get things right if we listen to them. If we ignore them, if we ignore that half of the population, that may encourage sort of the next person, you know, that Dan and company view as extreme and intolerant, and on and on and on and on. I think it may be one of the mistakes that many people, perhaps myself included, have made over the past decade, you know, because we call them the Tea Partiers. We call them the this, the that, the radical right wing, whatever it is. There is something going on, and it extends beyond sort of a narrow group. And I think it's in all of our interest to try to understand it.
We just want to get a few more questions in.
I think I'm going to go way out on a limb here and say that that probably a good number of people like me came to this evening discussion with the hopes that we would try to kind of plumb the depths a little bit of how is it that we've gotten where we are? How is it that we have a man like this, and I'm tipping my hand right off the bat, that is actually a serious candidate for for the President of the United States of America. How did we get here?
You know, I won't pretend to understand it. When I watch Trump rallies on TV, when I hear Trump talk, that's not the Republican Party that I signed up for when I was, you know, 18. It's not the Republican Party that I've, you know, where I've campaigned for other candidates, where I've run for office. That's not the Republican Party I know. And a lot of the things that he says scare me, go beyond the hateful things that he said, beyond even the misogyny and racist things, but fundamentally scare me. And so I try to listen to the people who support him. And what I hear from them, again, you know, for whatever my sample is worth, is it's a reflection of sort of generally what motivates us in many of our decisions in our lives. I think what often motivates us is, on the one hand, you know, love, and on the other hand, fear. And Trump has done a very, 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 very good job of speaking to a fear. You know, and I mentioned before, it has been a long time since many Western democracies have been involved on a wholesale level in a real war, in a real conflict, which has bound us together. You know, think of the country we were more immediately post 9/11. We're sort of a long way from that. And I think Trump has done a very good job at pointing to the other, and whether it's people of other religions, other races, other countries, and making people fearful of that, and also exposing a genuine and in some ways well-founded fear in many people of the future. Our economy is a potentially scary thing. Our educational system is a potentially scary thing. And, you know, the people that Colin was talking to at the Trump rallies are likely to be among the most affected by that. We are seeing jobs outsourced overseas, and we're not seeing the readily available replacement jobs. And so I think, you know, that fear really is a substantial motivator, and there is really not much on the other side, sort of the love side. You know, I'm a Republican who carried around Bill Clinton's 1993 inaugural address on my phone. You know, he was a candidate who I think could speak to our better angels, you know, tell the story of America going forward in a way that Hillary Clinton and you know, the other candidates in this election haven't been able to do. And I think that's a lot of what's going on.
You know, that was such a good answer. I think we might just end the evening right there, if that's okay with everybody. Plus, we've also had you sitting here in these seats for a really long time. I do want to tell you a couple of other things. First of all, if you had a good time tonight and you've never been here before, come back in January. It's going to be a very different kind of night. We're going to be celebrating the genius and the music of Brian Wilson. We're assuming that it's going to be very cold in January and you're going to be unhappy. It'll be dark and you'll want to hear beautiful music about sun and the beach. We'll have Watkins and has this wonderful piano that they don't like us messing around with that much, but we're going to take it out. We're going to bring musicians in here and experts on the music of Brian Wilson. So come back for that. We'll have another one of these dinners, and we'll talk about music. And you guys, we always said the January ones, which are always about music, we always make you guys sing with us. We give you the lyrics, and you sing some songs. And that might be good for you, too. Maybe after the election that we've been through, you'll need that a lot. I want a big hand for this incredible panel tonight. Vivian Martin, Dan Haar, Ross Garber. Thanks again to FIA and to Watkinson School. We'll see you in January.
And stronger than ever before, and we will make America great again.
Hey, Mr. Trump, why can't we all get
children, settle down. Settle down. I want to tell you about the final month of the near-tragic 2016 election. That's right, children. 50 years ago, the Republic was saved single-handedly by, I'm sure you know him by, his holiday and his national monument, Ken Bone.